maybe three quarters don't even remember the name of the imam. Unfortunately, this is a musibah of Ahlul Bayt. There were the musibah of Ahlul Bayt, and we are at times the zalim who are doing dhulm to them through this. Because we remember, this is a very important hadith, that the a'imma were asked, is there any distinction between obedience to Ali ibn Abi Talib and to Imam Ridha, for example? He says, no. There is no distinction to be made in terms of wilaya, in terms of obedience, in terms of love, and in terms of commitment between the ninth imam and the first imam, both whose birthdays are in the same week. Yet if we were to come on Friday, we'd probably see 15 times the audience. Is this not a kind of dhulm to the imam of our time? Isn't it? Shouldn't some of us be ashamed of ourselves? Is this something based on the deen, based on the ahadith of a'imma that have said that give more precedence to Ali ibn Abi Talib's birthday than the birthday of my grandson Imam al-Jawad? No. It is cultural, of course. And of course, Amir al-Mu'mineen has his own status. There's no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, for us, they're all ma'asumeen. And obedience to them is equal. A hadith of Imam al-Jawad and a hadith of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhim ajma'in, in terms of aqidah, in terms of sharia, in terms of akhlaq, in terms of every single subject, there is no tam'eez or tafsir to be done, or distinction between the two.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
People squeezed by inflation and demanding economic justice took to streets across Europe to mark May Day in an outpouring of worker discontent not seen since before the worldwide COVID-19 lockdowns. But what is May Day and why is it celebrated on May 1st? Also referred to as International Workers' Day, people across the world commemorate the contributions of workers and the labor movement on this day. Although observed as an ancient Northern Hemisphere spring festival initially, May 1st became associated with the labor movement in the late 19th century, after trade unions and socialist groups decided to designate it as a day in support of the working class people. The decision was taken in memory of Chicago's Haymarket Affair, which took place on May 4, 1886, when a violent clash broke out between the police and labor protesters. The incident happened after a bomb went off at Haymarket Square in Chicago, where the police had arrived to break a peaceful rally. Ultimately, 7 police officers were killed and 60 others were injured before the violence ended. It's estimated that 4 to 8 civilians died and 30 to 40 were wounded. Many of the protesters who were demonstrating against workers' rights violations, long work hours, poor working conditions, low wages, and child labor were arrested and served terms of life imprisonment, death sentences, and so forth. And those who died were hailed as Haymarket martyrs. The Haymarket affair had a lasting effect on the workers' movement and helped push forward the demands for better working conditions across the world. This year's May Day events unleashed pent-up frustration after 3 years of COVID-19 restrictions. For months, Europe has seen a series of strikes as workers demand higher wages in the face of record-high inflation rates. In the 19-nation euro currency zone, the annual inflation rate was at an all-time high of 10.6% in October. It retreated slightly to 10.1% in November, but that was still the second highest monthly rate since the creation of the euro in 1999. Hundreds of thousands of people massed in cities around France to vent their anger against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform. Protests took a violent turn as the day progressed, with protesters and security forces clashing. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin told reporters that at least 108 police officers were wounded, with 291 detained across the country. Protesters threw projectiles at police and broke windows of business buildings, including banks and estate agents in Paris. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons in return. Trade unions had called for more than 300 rallies and vowed to continue fighting even after the changes were signed into law. Protests had started largely peacefully, although police in Paris arrested 22 people, while in Lyon, police used tear gas to disperse crowds after bank windows were smashed. Sophie Binet, leader of the CGT union, said Macron's pension reform had left her isolated.
You just have to look at the procession behind. You can see that today is a historic May Day. There hasn't been such an important May Day in France since 1936, so we can't talk about running out of steam. We can't talk about decay. We can see that this day of mobilization is a stinging denial of all the bets made by the government and of the choice that the government was thinking of making to force us to turn the page.
Protesters mobilized against President Emmanuel Macron's recent move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Organizers see pension reform as a threat to hard-fought worker rights, while Macron argues it's economically necessary as the population ages.
Canada and one of the largest industrial actions in the country's history. Some 155,000 public workers are on strike in a dispute with the government over pay. While wages are a primary sticking point, the unions also want remote work included in their collective agreement. Cleaners and cooks, clerks and maintenance workers, tradespeople, Coast Guard search and rescue teams, teachers, firefighters, and workers who process employment insurance, passport applications, and immigration documents have now walked out of their jobs.
And I can tell you that we do not have a tentative agreement. The Public Service Alliance of Canada, 155,000 members, will be on strike as of 12:01 a.m. We will remain at the table. We will remain for as long as it takes during the strike. And we will remain on strike until the government addresses our key issues.
The strike has already disrupted public services in various sectors. Lawyers say the strike has affected everyone from refugee claimants whose hearings are cancelled to sponsored relatives stuck in limbo and from migrant workers to foreign students. The workers' union have failed to reach an agreement with the federal government in an effort to bring the industrial action to an end. On Saturday, the Canadian government negotiators presented the striking public workers with what they called a final offer. The Treasury Board, which oversees public administration, said details are being kept to the negotiating table, but the proposal included an enhanced wage offer and addressed issues including telework, seniority, and contracting. In a statement, the Treasury Board called the offer fair, competitive, and reasonable. The offer, however, has so far failed to bring the strikes to a halt. The workers are escalating their strike action in a bid to block several Canadian ports to pressure the government to get their demands met, including raising wages in line with the cost of living crisis and the soaring inflation. This is while inflation in Canada rose to a peak of more than 8% last June. It is expected to remain above 3% until the fourth quarter of this year. The strikes in Canada come as the country is gripped with an unfathomable economic crisis that includes soaring food insecurity. A chief executive of one of the country's leading food banks, the Daily Bread, said hundreds of thousands of people stream in each month to get food.
We are absolutely in a food crisis in the country and certainly in the city of Toronto. Before the pandemic, we saw about 60,000 clients saying, I'm food insecure. And that number this past March is 270,000. It has escalated by four times, and in a country as wonderful as Canada is, it just shouldn't be that way.
Hetherington said of the newcomers to the 128 food banks across the Toronto area affiliated with the Daily Bread, many have full-time jobs but still can't make ends meet. Visitors to food banks in other parts of Canada also echo a sense of despair and need with long queues to get something to eat at food banks. Hetherington said accommodations, both rentals and homes for sales, are out of reach for many Canadians across the country. This comes at a time when a lengthy period of higher rates could force an increasing share of highly indebted Canadians to reset their mortgages at levels that squeeze their finances. But regardless of all the economic hardships the Canadian people are going through, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spent 1.32% of its GDP on defense in the fiscal year of 2021-2022. Canadian authorities also continue with their pledge to provide Ukraine with military support in its war with Russia. After all, Canada has been one of the most vocal supporters of Ukraine and has provided billions of dollars in financial and military assistance to Kyiv since January 2022. Apart from that, Canada is the sixth largest contributor to NATO's common funded budget by allocating 13.7% of defense spending on major equipment in 2021 and 2022. Canadian authorities claim that the assistance is for Ukraine in what they call its fight for democracy. They, however, know perfectly well that they are using billions of dollars of the Canadian taxpayers' money to inject into a war which does not serve Canada at all and only favors the expansionist policy of the United States. Instead, if this money is allocated to address Canada's internal economic concerns, what else can force more than 150,000 Canadians to walk out of their jobs and call for better pays, which would subsequently disrupt all public services and make public and private sectors dysfunctional? On her first official visit to the Islamic Republic since taking office, Iraqi President Abdel Latif Rashid has visited Tehran to hold talks with Iranian high-ranking authorities. Upon arrival, the Iraqi leader met with President Ebrahim Raisi at the Saadabad complex, where he received an official welcome by the Iranian top executive official. The two sides then held a joint press conference, with boosting bilateral relations between Tehran and Baghdad being the focus of their remarks.
With regards to political, trade and economic issues, as well as the cultural domain, we have so far had good relations in those areas, and both countries are set to further expand their mutual relations.
So it's clear and is a reality that relations between Iran and Iraq are constant and solid and unchangeable.
But enhancing trade relations and economic development was not the only issue discussed between the two presidents. President Raisi and the Iraqi leader also addressed issues concerning regional security.
A security agreement was reached between the two countries, and the slightest insecurity anywhere in Iraq is regarded as insecurity for Iran. So the security of Iraq is very important for us. The security of borders is important to us, and the security arrangements between the two countries can lead not only to the security of both countries, but the security of the whole region.
For his part, the Iraqi leader praised the role of Tehran in providing assistance to the Iraqi people during the rule of former dictator Saddam Hussein and at a time when the Arab country was gripped with foreign-backed terrorism by the Daesh terror group. The presence of foreign forces was also among issues discussed by the two presidents. President Raisi said, "As much as we consider useful the negotiations between the regional countries, we do not consider the presence of foreign forces in the region to be useful, and we regard the presence of Americans as a threat to the security of the region." Raisi said Iran's ties with Iraq and other countries of the region are based on common interests, but Americans only think of their own interests. Later on Saturday, the Iraqi president also met with the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. During the meeting, the leader called on Baghdad to get U.S. troops out of the Arab country, saying even one American soldier on the Iraqi soil is too many. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. is not a friend of Iraq, adding that Washington is not even loyal to its European allies. The visit by the Iraqi leader to Tehran is of very high significance, both concerning Iraq's internal problems and regional and international issues. At a national level, the visit comes at a time when, according to Iran's president, the level of commercial and economic ties between the two countries exceed $10 billion. Not to mention that this figure can upgrade to a much higher level. According to President Raisi, relations between the two countries continue in various fields, including infrastructure, water, electricity, gas, and energy. These are the sectors that Iraq has been suffering the most from during the past couple of decades or so. That especially comes to the spotlight at a time when Iraq is trying to rebuild itself following its 23 U.S. invasion and the eradication of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The boosting of economic relations between Tehran and Baghdad not only will bring these two nations closer to each other, it would also help Iraq stand on its own feet after the U.S.-led war and occupation. This will also preserve the sovereignty of Iraq, given that the country has managed to be among those who have exempted themselves from the U.S. sanction measures on the Islamic Republic by continuing its trade with Tehran. After all, Iran plays a great role in developing the Iraqi infrastructure, and the presence of the Iraqi high-level delegation in Tehran can be an indication of that. In a broader perspective, Iraq has been hosting 5 rounds of negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and along with China, has facilitated the recent rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. That is something that would undeniably contribute to security and stability in the region. At an international level, it's not hidden to anyone that the West, namely the United States and its allies, have for decades been sowing discord and division among nations in the West Asia region to fulfill their own political and economic interests. Maybe that's exactly why these West Asian nations have come to an understanding that they should form a coalition and stand in the face of the West and its agenda, which merely aims to divide and conquer.
Iran's English language news channel, Press TV, has been targeted again. The two organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, and the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH. Their accusation, in their words, Iranian state TV using social media to evade broadcast bans and spread anti-Semitic hate campaigns. That's according to their website. This is a new report that it compiled as proof that Iran's Press TV is guilty of spreading anti-Semitic hate campaigns. And this is the report. It begins with the accusation, which includes this icon, State Hate, how Iran's Press TV uses social media to promote anti-Jewish hatred. It elaborates on this and says that Press TV is a platform used to promote the Iranian state's hateful views of Jewish people, amongst other accusations. So is Press TV guilty of that? Well, for starters, if reporting on the deaths and violations of Palestinians is a crime, yes, it is. Press TV doesn't need to work that hard to cover Israeli atrocities. The Israeli regime does a good job of that, beating Palestinians, killing them, and evicting them from their homes, almost on a daily basis. Furthermore, the current fascist ministers openly threaten Palestinians, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has called for the execution of Palestinians who act against Israel, or the Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who has called for Palestinians to be wiped out. These are genocidal calls, but the Israeli media or organizations like the ADL do not cover this. However, looking deeper into this, it becomes clear that the driving force behind this attack on Press TV are these two men, Chris Williamson and David Miller. But who are they, and why are they being targeted? ADL's attack on Press TV became clear on why it had accused it of anti-Semitism. It had targeted Chris Williamson and David Miller because of their role in the program Palestine Declassified, as stated here. In terms of the program itself, it sheds light on Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
But academic studies have found a long-standing pro-Israel bias within the UK's broadcast media.
They're trying to do some propaganda here to bully the BBC, which has been very, very effective.
It's because they are never properly challenged.
As if that is not alarming for the Israeli regime, the host and producer both have a rich bio when it comes to their views on Palestinians. Christopher Williamson is a British politician who was a member of Parliament for Derby North from 2010 to 2015 and again from 2017 to 2019. He's been associated with many British politicians like Jeremy Corbyn. And because of this, he has also been targeted for his role as a British MP, where he was stripped of his parliamentary pass.
Yeah, well, the first I heard about it was when I was contacted by a British newspaper called The Daily Mail. It's an absurd proposition. I mean, it's, because people may have objections to the Iranian government.
For ADL, having a former British MP hosting a TV program for Iran's Press TV exposing Israeli atrocities is just too much to bear. Then comes David Miller, former professor at Bristol University, producer and co-host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified. He was fired from the university since he said Israel is a violent, racist, foreign regime engaged in ethnic cleansing.
Because there's a huge amount of documentation going along with the case, and that's where we will find whether the university has wrongfully dismissed me, and also whether the court will determine that I was discriminated against on grounds of my political beliefs, which is the claim that we're making.
Press TV is proud to defend the rights of Palestinians and oppressed people anywhere in the world. It has done so through its inception 17 years ago, and the station has been successful in reaching the voice of the oppressed people of Palestine to the world. Even ADL admits the incredible reach of Press TV, that although it was banned from TV and YouTube, it continues to reach up to 11.5 million followers. While Press TV enjoys this high exposure, ADL's post on Twitter had a measly 26,400 views with only 78 likes. So at the end, we ask, who is winning the social media war?
Could the turmoil in Israel prove to be terminal for the Zionist entity?
Limelight. Rating agency Fitch has downgraded France's credit rating. The agency says France's social unrest over pensions could limit the government's ability to pass new structural changes. In this regard, We have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, rating agency Fitch has downgraded France's sovereign credit rating, warning that public resistance to a recent pension reform could take a toll on the economy. The agency lowered the rating from AA to AA- with a stable outlook. The downgrade means France is considered a more risky venture for investors, which could lead to higher borrowing costs. Fitch believes that social and political pressures illustrated by the protest against the pension reform will complicate fiscal consolidation, the agency wrote. It added that the government's decision to bypass a parliamentary vote to push through the pension reform will likely further strengthen radical and anti-establishment forces. Political deadlock and sometimes violent social movements pose a risk to Macron's reform agenda and could create pressures for a more expansionary fiscal policy or a reversal of previous reforms, Fitch warned. French President Emmanuel Macron signed the unpopular pension reform into law in mid-April, despite months of nationwide protests and resistance in Parliament. The measure raised the retirement age from 62 to 64. Following its enactment, the political opposition and unions vowed to continue contesting the move. Analysts have warned that as the president's party does not have a parliamentary majority, it may be difficult for it to deliver on other reforms due to the public unrest. French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire, however, pledged that Paris will continue structural reforms despite Fitch's warnings. I believe that the facts invalidate the assessment by the Fitch agency. We are able to implement structural reforms, and we will continue to implement structural reforms for the country, Le Maire told Agence France-Presse recently. The official vowed to accelerate the country's debt reduction to restore the public finances, reduce deficits, and make faster cuts to public expenditure. Sales volumes at major retail chains in France have declined in the first 3 months of the year against a backdrop of soaring prices, news channel BFMTV reported recently, citing a study by analytical center Destricana Institute. BFMTV stated, faced with inflation, the French reduced their purchases in the first quarter, according to the Destricana Institute. Supermarket sales in the first 3 months of this year fell by 5% compared to 2022. It indicated that surging prices pushed the turnover of large-scale retailers up by 9.1% during the same period in annual terms. Data showed that sales of oils have been the most affected, plummeting by 53.1%. Sales of care and hygiene products reportedly dropped by 52.8%, while starch sales declined by 26.4%. The cost of living crisis has deepened in France. According to a recent report by statistics agency INSEE, inflation in the Eurozone's second largest economy continued to grow at a record pace and rose faster than expected in February, largely due to surging food prices. Food services and manufactured goods have been the main contributors to rising inflation. French authorities previously introduced a so-called anti-inflation food baskets comprising about 50 basic items and have obliged large retailers not to hike prices on these essentials. Inflation in France continues to soar at a record pace and rose faster than expected in February, largely due to surging food prices, according to the most recent calculations by statistics agency INSEE published recently. Consumer prices increased from a projected 7.2% to 7.3% in February year-on-year, up from 7% in January, and representing the strongest increase in France's euro area, INSEE said. This latest report shows that food, services, and manufactured goods have been the main contributors to rising inflation. Earlier this month, the government warned French households that inflation will accelerate to reach 10% in March, which means that food prices will also increase by 10%. The country's authorities have introduced a so-called anti-inflation food basket comprising about 50 basic items and have obliged large retailers not to hike prices on these essentials. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said he expected inflation to reach a peak this summer and then start to ease. Banque de France Governor François Villeroy de Gallo acknowledged that inflation across the Eurozone remained too high and continues to be the main concern and top priority for monetary policy.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the life and works of the Muslim Shiite personalities and ulama all across the world. I am Ata, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars of the 13th, 14th century Hijra, Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, also known as Mirzai Dovom or Mirzai Kuchak, he was the leader of the independence political movement of Iraq against the supremacy of Britain. We can say most of his fatwa and fatwas were issued against the Britain and the foreign powers' presence in Iraq. He was a very much committed scholar and alim, not limiting himself only to Islamic courses or the Islamic seminaries. Politically and socio-culturally, he was very much active. Said Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Muhammad Taghi Shirazi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Muhammad Taghi Shirazi was known as Mirza, second Mirza, or Mirza Kuchik, and obviously he was in Iraq. About his initial life, it is said that Mirza Muhammad Taghi Shirazi was in Karbala, and there he started his educational life. And after that, he went to Samarra, where he has taken some lessons from the great Mirza, who was famous for his tobacco.
Yes, Mirza Hassan Shirazi.
Mirza Hassan Shirazi, who was famous about his fatwa of tobacco. Over there, obviously, he lived there, and he made many students. And obviously, his life was full of, we can say, like different activities, where he was involved with the immigrants who went to the Karbala. He was also involved with the people, the different tribes, who were obviously ready for resistance. And this made his, we can say like, you know, it made him a famous and popular personality. When we talk about his students, we can see like Agha Bozorg Tehrani, one of the great scholars, Abdul Karim Hayri, who basically based or who founded the, who put the foundation of Hawza al-Miyakum after Najaf. These are from his students. We have Muhammad Jawad Balaghi Najafi from his students who wrote Allah al-Rahman. And there are many, many other scholars, Muhammad Ali Shah Abadi, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, who is known because of his library. He's buried in Qom. These are from his students. So he was at the time when obviously the England, it tried to invade the Iraq, and obviously these were the scholars of that time who resist against such invasion.
That's all right. We know that. That's all right. After the demise of Mirza Muhammad Hassan Shirazi and also Akhund Khorasani, the Marja'iyatul Am, or the general Marja'iyya, or custodianship of the Islamic seminaries, was on the shoulders of some ulama like Sheikh al-Sharia Isfahani, Sheikh Mahdi Khalisi, Sayyid Kazemi Yazdi, and also Muhammad Taghi Shirazi. But Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, even during his marja'iyya, felt very much responsible in order to defend the borders of Islam, especially in Iraq and in Iran, against the foreign powers, the British powers and the Russian powers. Sheikh Rouhani, I think this aspect of his life might be very much interesting, especially for those who do not think that Islam or Shia Islam might be a political one, because after the Islamic Revolution of Iran take place, most of the people think that, okay, Ayatollah Khomeini was the first one who, for example, founded this system, but it has a rich legacy, isn't it?
Yes, of course. As you know, one of the main principles of Islam is jihad.
Yes.
Struggling in the way of Allah to protect and defend Muslims against the enemy's attack. So that's why, based on this principle, you see that Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Shirazi in 1329 of Qamari, he actually, when the Russian forces attacked the north part of Iran, he actually issued a fatwa calling upon the people to defend themselves against the Russian attack.
Yes.
It was a very famous fatwa that was issued by him in that time. And also in the at the beginning of the First World War, when the coalition forces actually started fighting in war against, waged a war against Ottoman Empire. And so when they attacked the Ottoman areas, Then when they came to the Fao, which is a city, I think, in Iraq.
Yes.
When they actually occupied this area, Fao, I mean, in Iraq.
Yes.
Then Mirza Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, at that time he was in Samarra, he issued a fatwa and invited the tribes and Ashair of Muslimin to start fighting against the British army in that area to defend their land and to actually protect their people against the Britishers. These were the two very famous fatwa which were issued by this alim or this Shiite scholar. It shows that how much political is the position or status of Marja'iyya in the Shiite ideology or in the Shiite system of thought, because you see, whenever you are attacked by, or Muslims are attacked by the enemies, it is the responsibility of a marja'i taqlid, of the religious leader, to defend the people, to issue the fatwa. And also, he, in one of these, let's say, battlefields, he sent his own son.
Yes.
Yeah, to defend the people, and he accompanied him. So that's why supported him.
Muhammad Reza, his son.
Yes,
Muhammad
of course.
Shirazi,
it shows that, yes, this is one of the main responsibilities of marja'i taqlid to even wage war against the the enemy's attack when it is needed. Yeah, that's it.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Founding of Jamaat al-Islamiyya or Jamiat al-Islami, Islamic Society, we can call it, was one of the outstanding achievements of this outstanding man, writing letters to different leaders of Muslim lands and also United States of America in defense of the Islamic lands, okay? According to so many documents, he was very much concerned with rulership of the Muslims over Muslims and not the non-Muslims, for example, Britain. And we know that at that time, Britain, through his spies in Iran and the embassies, wanted to rule Islamic lands, especially through, for example, some economic contracts in Iran and some monopolizing, for example, some lands in Iraq. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, in one of the most outstanding fatwas, we read that no Muslim has the right to select a non-Muslim as his ruler in the Muslim lands. This is an important fatwa of him. Let's talk a little bit about this aspect of his life.
Well, obviously, when we look at his political life, we can find this aspect in his letters which he wrote, the political letters. For example, like he wrote a letter to Sharif Hussein, who was the ruler of Hijaz at that time. And in that, he wanted him to support the society, the Islamic society, the Islamic society of the Iraq, so that because they're raising against, or they're having resistance against the non-Muslims. On the other hand, he wrote a letter to the Amir Faisal, who was in Syria, in Damascus, and he asked him to convey the message of Sheikh and his supporters. Why? Because the Damascus had the access to the international media, and they were free. For example, if that, at that time it was radio and other sorts of means of the media, so they had open access to it. And he asked them, he requested them to convey our message to the world so that the world knows that the Iraqi people, they don't want the invasion of the Britons over them. Other than that, we can see like with Sheikh Sharia Isfahani, he wrote a letter to the USA, to the Americans, the president of America, that all the people of Iraq, they want a new government, which should be independent, number one. Number two, an Islamic independent state. Why? Because the Muslims are living here. And number two, they want to choose someone as a king, a Muslim king who is bound to the Islamic rules and not someone who is a non-Muslim. They are not allowed to rule over the Muslims. So we can see from these letters that he was so concerned about it. And this idea that the Muslims can only rule the Muslims, this is true. Obviously, we know that even the Quranic teachings, the Islamic teachings is all about that. The reason is that when there is a ruler who is bound to the Islamic rules, Islamic laws, he, according to the Quran, must be a just person. Obviously, he look after the rituals of the Muslims. And obviously, there is no contradiction. For example, you know, we have people right now living in the West.
Yes.
Right? And they are the Muslims. They are free to, you know, observe or to practice their Islam. But the point is the environment in which they are.
Yes, yes.
That is not an Islamic environment. You know, for example, there is non-mahram. There is half-naked people. So a person who wants to observe Islam, who wants to practice Islam, where Islam says that the woman should cover herself, now there is a hurdle for this person to do that. Similarly, for the women, obviously, when they go to the work, there is a special dress code they cannot. So these are the reasons that we can see today, those who do not understand this, that what will happen if a non-Muslim ruler will rule a Muslim land? The reason is that a non-Muslim ruler will bring alcohol into the Muslim land. The non-Muslim ruler will bring the other things that contradicts with the Islamic laws. So when he is not bound to them, the people, you know, we have the hadith, "An-nasu ala dini muluki." The people are upon the religion of their kings.
That's
so
right.
When the rulership is in the hands of a non-Muslim, then obviously there is a big chance of Muslims becoming non-Muslim.
That's right. So many letters were sent from the head of the tribes because Iraq at that time was a tribal country that, for example, the British and the Russian powers are attacking them and want them to yield to the orders of the British. What should we do? And Mirza, in his outstanding fatwa, had said that defending your rights and defending your movement, defending your people and your country is, we can't say, an obligation for you. And if you yield up to their needs, to their orders, you are doing a haram action. And that's why, for example, the British powers on that time and the Britain on that time could not occupy so many parts of Iraq, that land. He said that I sacrifice everything. I sacrifice my son, my companions, my comrades. I am ready to sacrifice my own life to defend Islam. On that time, all in all, we could see that the Hausa was not only active in the, for example, Islamic seminaries of Najaf and Karbala and Samarra. You know, the students and the Islamic seminaries were really much active and felt responsible to, about the affairs of the community. Okay, what other details, Sheikh Rouhani, about his political life?
Yes, one of the other things that is interesting in his life is that he tried to manage or to rule over the city of Karbala. And also he appointed some people to manage the affairs of the holy shrine of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and to help the people of Karbala. And he himself was observing as an observer on all those things that were done by some of the people who were appointed by him in the city of Karbala. It was also one of the interesting points in his life that is also a kind of social activities of this marja-i taqlid at that time.
That's right. We know that Karbala was freed from the hands, we can say by the hands of the mujahids on that time, and so many outstanding ulama like Sayyid Abul Ghassam Kashani, Sayyid Hussein Qazvini, Sayyid Habaduddin Shahristani were ever active over there in the city of Karbala. That's right. He passed away in a mysterious way on Zilhijjah 13, 1338. According to some documents, he was poisoned by the Britishers. It is not something far away from the thoughts because he was against the Britishers. Sheikh Sharia Isfahani did the burial pray and he was buried in the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And most of the cities, most tribes in Iraq held morning sessions
a morning gatherings for the late Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, or Shahid Muhammad Taghi Shirazi, mainly known as Mirzai Dovom or Mirzai Kuchak. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding his life. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information and to download for free our previous episodes of the program The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight. The Treasury Department warned Congress on Monday that the deadline to raise the U.S. debt ceiling is rapidly approaching. President Biden invited House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other congressional leaders to the White House next week to discuss the debt ceiling. As Washington scrambled on Monday, 1st of May, to respond to news that the government could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June. President Biden's request for talks followed a jarring new projection from the Treasury Department that the government could run out of cash to pay its bills in as few as 4 weeks without additional borrowing authority. An unprecedented event that could rattle world financial markets and tip the fragile U.S. economy into another recession. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CNN cable news network has covered this story. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of May, called the top four congressional leaders, including House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, to discuss raising the debt ceiling at the White House later this month, following months of an impasse between the president and the House Republicans. President Biden's call came after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen notified lawmakers on Monday that the U.S. could default on its debt obligations by 1st of June. Biden told congressional leaders, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, that he wants to discuss on 9th of May the need to pass a clean bill to raise the debt ceiling. The president's formal call for a meeting follows a month-long standoff between Biden and the Republicans over the debt ceiling issue. Biden has not met with Kevin McCarthy since February. And earlier, on Monday, the House Speaker said he had not yet heard from the president about debt ceiling talks, despite the fact that the House passed a package to raise the debt ceiling by $1.5 trillion last week. The bill also includes spending cuts, beefed-up work requirements in safety net programs, and other measures that Democrats would not accept. Chuck Schumer has described the House legislation as dead on arrival in the Senate. Following the bill's passage in the House, the president told reporters he would be happy to meet with Kevin McCarthy, but not on whether or not the debt limit gets extended. The White House has maintained that the president would only accept a clean proposal to raise the nation's borrowing limit. A White House official told CNN on Monday that at the proposed meeting with congressional leaders, Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions, and invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, as well as how to initiate a separate process to address the budget and fiscal year 2024 appropriations. Reaction from Capitol Hill underscored on Monday that the partisan battle lines remain entrenched over this issue. Republican senators urged President Biden to get to the negotiating table with Kevin McCarthy, while Senate Democrats vowed they would not negotiate with Republicans on raising the debt limit. Senate Minority Whip John Thune said the news that the U.S. could default on 1st of June if Congress does not act reinforces the need for Biden to negotiate with McCarthy. Time is being wasted, the Republican from South Dakota said as he entered Mitch McConnell's office. But Hawaii Democrat Senator Brian Schatz accused Republicans of hostage-taking and said Democrats would not give in to that threat. This is not just abnormal, but reckless. To take the American economy hostage, this cannot be tolerated, Senator Schatz said. The only thing scarier than not negotiating with these people is negotiating with them, because they will never ever stop holding Americans and the American economy hostage. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story. President Biden called the four congressional leaders on Monday afternoon and invited them to a 9th of May meeting on the debt ceiling, according to three people familiar with the calls. The White House later announced in a statement that the invitation had been made. This afternoon, President Biden called Speaker Kevin McCarthy to invite him to a meeting at the White House on 9th of May with congressional leaders Jeffries, Schumer, and McConnell, who the president also called today. According to a White House official in this meeting with congressional leaders, President Biden will stress that Congress must take action to avoid default without conditions. The president invited the four congressional leaders to the White House to discuss the urgency of preventing default, the official said. And at the same time, President Biden plans to raise with them how a separate process might be initiated to address the budget and appropriations for the 2024 fiscal year. The invitation comes as Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the U.S. could default on its debt obligations as soon as 1st of June, less than a month away. The White House also confirmed the calls. The White House has repeatedly insisted that it's up to Congress and Republicans who control the House of Representatives to avoid default, even as the House passed a bill last week to raise the debt limit and cut spending. That bill is unlikely to pass the Senate. It's not yet clear that the invitations have been accepted by the congressional leaders or that 9th of May is a firm date. NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden has called the top four congressional leaders to a meeting on 9th of May at the White House to discuss how to avert a debt default, according to a White House official and Capitol Hill sources familiar with the matter. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned in a letter on Monday that the U.S. could breach the debt ceiling by 1st of June, earlier than expected, if Congress doesn't act in time. The letter sent shockwaves across Capitol Hill with the threat of economic calamity looming as Congress and the White House remained deadlocked over the issue. There was little sign on Monday, 1st of May, that either party was shifting off its position. House Republicans insist on attaching spending cuts to a debt ceiling increase, while Democrats vow not to negotiate over whether to pay the country's bills or default. The White House official said Biden will stress to congressional leaders that they must take action to avoid default without any preconditions, saying the meeting was scheduled to discuss the urgency of preventing default as well as how to begin negotiating a budget. Democrats have insisted on a clean debt limit increase without policy conditions and for Congress to negotiate over spending cuts Republicans demanded in the separate government funding process, which has a deadline of 30th of September. That is the appropriate place to debate and discuss our nation's fiscal picture, not in a hostage situation in which extreme MAGA Republicans try to impose their radical agenda on America, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said in a joint statement on Monday evening. We do not have the luxury of waiting until 1st of June to come together, pass a clean bill to avoid a default and prevent catastrophic consequences for our economy and millions of American families. Republicans cannot allow right-wing extremism to hold our nation hostage, Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries wrote. President Biden also called Congress's top two Republicans, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, on Monday.